7. Space battles in movies and Hollies had always bored me, but watching the real thing held a certain fascination, rather like seeing live coverage of a series of traffic accidents. Actually, the production values for reality, as had doubtless been the case for centuries, were much lower than for even a moderate-budget holodrama. Even with the tremendous energies involved, the overwhelming reaction one had to an actual battle in space was that space was so large, and humanity's fleets and ships and dreadnoughts and whatnots were so small. Or so I thought, as I sat in the Tactical Information Center, the so-called War Room, with Gladstone and her military ganders, and watched the walls become 20-meter holes into infinity, as four massive hollow frames surrounded us with in-depth imagery and the speakers filled the room with fat-line transmissions. Radio chatter between fighters, tactical command channels rattling away, ship-to-ship messages on wideband, lasered channels and secure fat-line, and all the shouts, screams, cries, and obscenities of battle which predate any media besides air and the human voice. It was a dramatization of total chaos, a functional definition of confusion, an unchoreographed dance of sad violence. It was war. Gladstone and a handful of her people sat in the middle of all this noise and light, the war room floating like a gray-carpeted rectangle amidst the stars and explosions, the limb of Hyperion, a lapis-lazuli brilliance filling half of the north hollow wall, the screams of dying men and women on every channel and in every ear. I was one of the handful of Gladstone's people privileged and cursed to be there. The CEO rotated in her high-backed chair, tapped her lower lip with steepled fingers, and turned toward her military group. "What do you think?" The 7 bemedaled men there looked at one another, and then 6 of them looked at General Morpurgo. He chewed on an unlighted cigar.
"It's not good," he said. "We're keeping them away from the Farcaster site. Our defenses are holding well there, but they've pushed far too far in system."
"Admiral?" asked Gladstone, inclining her head a fraction toward the tall, thin man in force space black. Admiral Singh touched his closely trimmed beard.
"General Morpurgo is correct. The campaign is not going as planned." He nodded toward the fourth wall, where diagrams, mostly ellipsoids, ovals, and arcs, were superimposed upon a static shot of the Hyperion system. Some of the arcs grew as we watched. The bright blue lines stood for hegemony trajectories. The red tracks were ouster. There were far more red lines than blue.
"Both of the attack carriers assigned to Task Force 42 have been put out of action," said Admiral Singh. "The Olympus Shadow was destroyed with all hands, and the Neptune station was seriously damaged, but is returning to the cislunar docking area with 5 tort ships for escort."
CEO Gladstone nodded slowly, her lip coming down to touch the top of her steepled fingers.
"How many were aboard the Olympus Shadow, Admiral?"
Singh's brown eyes were as large as the CEO's, but did not suggest the same depths of sadness. He held her gaze for several seconds.
4,200, he said, "not counting the marine detachment of 600. Some of those were offloaded at Farcaster Station Hyperion, so we do not have accurate information on how many were with the ship."
Gladstone nodded. She looked back at General Morpurgo. "Why the sudden difficulty, General?" Morpurgo's face was calm, but he had all but bitten through the cigar clamped between his teeth.
"More fighting units than we expected, CEO," he said. "Plus their lancers. 5-person craft, miniature tort ships, really faster and more heavily armed than our long-range fighters. They're deadly little hornets. We've been destroying them by the hundred, but if one gets through, it can make a dash inside fleet defenses and wreak havoc."
Morpurgo shrugged.
"More than one's got through."
Senator Kolchev sat across the table with 8 of his colleagues. Kolchev swiveled until he could see the tactical map.
"It looks like they're almost to Hyperion," he said.
The famous voice was hoarse.
Singh spoke up. Remember the scale, Senator. The truth is that we still hold most of the system. Everything within 10 AU of Hyperion's star is ours. The battle was out beyond the Oort cloud, and we've been regrouping.
And those red blobs above the plane of the ecliptic? Asked Senator Richaud.
The senator wore red herself. It had been one of her trademarks in the Senate.
Singh nodded.
An interesting stratagem, he said. The swarm launched an attack of approximately 3,000 lancers to complete a pincers movement against Task Force 87.2's electronic perimeter. It was contained, but one has to admire the cleverness of...
3,000 lancers, Gladstone interrupted softly.
Yes, ma'am.
Gladstone smiled. I stopped sketching and thought to myself that I was glad that I had not been the beneficiary of that particular smile. Weren't we told yesterday, in the briefing, that the ousters would field 600-700 fighting units tops? The words had been more Purgos. CEO Gladstone swiveled to face the general. Her right eyebrow arched. General Moore Purgo removed the cigar, frowned at it, and fished a smaller piece from behind his lower teeth.
That's what our intelligence said. It was wrong.
Gladstone nodded. Was the AI Advisory Council involved in that intelligence assessment? All eyes turned toward Counselor Albedo. It was a perfect projection. He sat in his chair amongst the others, his hands curled on the armrest in a relaxed fashion. There was none of the haziness or see-through common to mobile projections. His face was long, with high cheekbones and a mobile mouth which suggested a hint of sardonic smile, even at the most serious of moments. This was a serious moment.
No, CEO, said Counselor Albedo. The advisory group was not asked to assess ouster's strength.
Gladstone nodded. I assumed, she said, still addressing Moore Purgo, that when the force intelligence estimates came in, they incorporated the Council's projections. The force ground general glared at Albedo.
No, ma'am, he said. Since the Corps acknowledges no contact with the ousters, we felt that their projections wouldn't be any better than our own. We did use the OCS-HTN aggregate AI network to run our assessments.
He thrust the foreshortened cigar back into his mouth. His chin jutted. When he spoke, it was around the cigar.
Could the Council have done better?
Gladstone looked at Albedo. The Counselor made a small motion with the long fingers of his right hand.
Our estimates for this swarm suggested 4,000 to 6,000 fighting units. You...
began Moore Purgo, his face red.
You did not mention this during the briefing, said CEO Gladstone,
nor during our earlier deliberations. Counselor Albedo shrugged.
The general is correct, he said. We have no contact with the ousters. Our estimates are no more reliable than forces, merely based upon different premises. The Olympus Command School Historical Tactical Network does excellent work. If the AIs there were one order of acuity higher on the Turing-Demler scale, we would have to bring them into the Corps.
He made the graceful gesture with his hand again.
As it is, the Council's premises might be of use for future planning. We will, of course, turn over all projections to this group at any time.
Gladstone nodded. Do so immediately. She turned back to the screen, and the others did so also. Sensing the silence, the room monitors brought the speaker volume back up, and once again we could hear the cries of victory, screams for help, and calm recitation of positions, fire control directions, and commands. The closest wall was a real-time feed from the torch ship, HS N'Djamena, as it searched for survivors among the tumbling remnants of Battlegroup B.5. The damaged torch ship it was approaching, magnified 1,000 times, looked like a pomegranate burst from the inside, its seeds and red rind spilling in slow motion, tumbling into a cloud of particles, gases, frozen volatiles, 1,000,000 microelectronics ripped from their cradles, food stores, tangled gear, and, recognizable now and then from their marionette tumble of arms or legs, many, many bodies. the N'Djamena's searchlight, 10 meters wide after its coherent leap of 20,000 miles, played across the starlit frozen wreckage, bringing individual items, facets, and faces into focus.
It was quite beautiful in a terrible way. The reflected light made Gladstone's face look much older.
"Admiral," she said, "is it pertinent that the swarm waited until Task Force 87.2 translated in system?" Singh touched his beard.
"Are you asking if it was a trap, CEO?"
"Yes." The Admiral glanced at his colleagues and then at Gladstone.
"I think not. We believe, I believe, that when the ousters saw the intensity of our force commitment, they responded in kind. It does mean, however, that they are totally resolved to take Hyperion system."
"Can they do it?" asked Gladstone, her eyes still on the tumbling wreckage above her. A young man's body, half in a space suit and half out, tumbled toward the camera. The burst eyes and lungs were clearly visible.
"No," said Admiral Singh. "They can bloody us. They can even drive us back to a totally defensive perimeter around Hyperion itself. But they cannot defeat us or drive us out."
"Or destroy the Farcaster?"
Senator Risho's voice was taut.
"Nor destroy the Farcaster," said Singh. "He's right," said General Morpurgo. "I'd stake my professional career on it."
Gladstone smiled and stood. The others, including myself, rushed to stand also.
"You have," Gladstone said softly to Morpurgo.
"You have." She looked around. "We will meet here when events warrant it. M. Hunt will be my liaison with you. In the meantime, gentlemen and ladies, the work of government shall proceed. Good afternoon." As the others left, I took my seat again until I was the only one left in the room. The speakers came back up to volume. On one band a man was crying. Manic laughter came through static. Above me, behind me, on both sides, the star fields moved slowly against blackness, and the starlight glinted coldly on wreckage and ruin. Government House was constructed in the shape of a Star of David, and within the center of the star, shielded by low walls and strategically planted trees, there was a garden, smaller than the formal acres of flowers in Deer Park, but no less beautiful. I was walking there as evening fell, the brilliant blue-white of Tau Ceti fading to golds, when Mayna Gladstone approached. For a while we walked together in silence. I noticed that she had exchanged her suit for a long robe of the kind worn by grand matrons on Potoffa. The robe was wide and billowing, inset with intricate dark blue and gold designs, which almost matched the darkening sky. Gladstone's hands were out of sight in hidden pockets. The wide sleeves stirred to a breeze. The hem dragged on the milk-white stones of the path. "You let them interrogate me," I said. "I'm curious as to why."
Gladstone's voice was tired.
"They were not transmitting. There was no danger of the information being passed on."
I smiled.
"Nonetheless, you let them put me through that. Security wished to know as much about them as they would divulge, at the expense of any inconvenience on my part," I said.
"Yes.
And does security know who they were working for?"
"The man mentioned Harbrit," said the CEO.
"Security is fairly certain that they meant Emlem Harbrit."
"The commodities broker on Asquith?"
"Yes. She and Diana Philomel have ties with the old Glennon Height royalist factions."
"They were amateurs," I said.
Thinking of Hermund mentioning Harbrit's name, the confused order of Diana's questioning.
"Of course. Are the royalists connected to any serious group?"
"Only the Shrike Church," said Gladstone. She paused where the path crossed a small stream via a stone bridge. The CEO gathered her robe and sat on a wrought-iron bench. "None of the bishops have yet come out of hiding, you know."
"With the riots and backlash, I don't blame them," I said. I remained standing.
There were no bodyguards or monitors in sight. But I knew that if I were to make any threatening move toward Gladstone, I would wake up in exec-sec detention. Above us, the clouds lost their last tinge of gold and began to glow with the reflected silver light of TC Squared's countless tower cities. "What did security do with Diana and her husband?" I asked. "They've been thoroughly interrogated. They're being detained." I nodded. Thorough interrogation meant that even now their brains were floating in full-shunt tanks. Their bodies would be kept in cryogenic storage until a secret trial determined if their actions had been treasonable. After the trial, the bodies would be destroyed, and Diana and Hermund would remain in detention, with all sensory and calm channels turned off. The hegemony had not used the death penalty for centuries, but the alternatives were not pleasant. I sat on the long bench, 6 feet from Gladstone. "Do you still write poetry?" I was surprised by her question. I glanced down the garden path where floating Japanese lanterns and hidden glow globes had just come on. "Not really," I said. "Sometimes I dream in verse, or used to." Mayna Gladstone folded her hands on her lap and studied them. "If you were writing about the events unfolding now," she said, "what kind of poem would you create?" I laughed. "I've already begun it and abandoned it twice. Or rather, he had. It was about the death of the gods and their difficulty in accepting their displacement. It was about transformation and suffering and injustice. And it was about the poet, whom he thought suffered most at such injustice." Gladstone looked at me. Her face was a mass of lines and shadows in the dimming light. "And who are the gods that are being replaced this time, M. Severn? Is it humanity? Or the false gods we created to depose us?" "How the hell should I know?" I snapped and turned away to watch the stream. "You are part of both worlds, no? Humanity and Technocore." I laughed again. "I'm part of neither world. A cybrid monster here, a research project there." "Yes, but whose research? And for what ends?" I shrugged. Gladstone rose, and I followed. We crossed the stream and listened to water moving over the stones. The path wound between tall boulders covered with exquisite lichen, which glowed in the lantern light. Gladstone paused at the top of a short flight of stone steps. "Do you think the ultimates in the core will succeed in constructing their ultimate intelligence, M. Severn? Will they build God?" I said. "There are those AIs which do not want to build God. They learned from the human experience that to construct the next step in awareness is an invitation to slavery, if not actual extinction." "But would a true God extinguish his creatures?" "In the case of the core and the hypothetical UI," I said, "God is the creature, not the creator. Perhaps a god must create the lesser beings in contact with it, in order for it to feel any responsibility for them." "Yet the core has appeared to take responsibility for human beings in the centuries since the AI secession," said Gladstone. She was gazing intently at me, as if gauging something by my expression. I looked out at the garden. The path glowed whitely, almost eerily in the dark. "The core works toward its own ends," I said, knowing as I spoke that no human being knew that fact better than CEO Mayna Gladstone. "And do you feel that humanity no longer figures as a means toward those ends?" I made a dismissive gesture with my right hand. "I'm a creature of neither culture," I said again, "neither graced by the naivete of the unintentional creators, nor cursed by the terrible awareness of their creatures." "Genetically, you are fully human," said Gladstone. It was not a question. I did not respond. "Jesus Christ was said to be fully human," she said, "and also fully divine. Humanity and Godhead at intersection." I was amazed at her reference to that old religion. Christianity had been replaced first by Zen Christianity, then Zen Gnosticism,
then by 100 more vital theologies and philosophies. Gladstone's home world was no repository for discarded beliefs, and I assumed and hoped that neither was the CEO. If he was fully human and fully God, I said, then I am his antimatter image.
No, said Gladstone. I would imagine that the shrike your pilgrim friends are confronting is that.
I stared. It was the first time she had mentioned the shrike to me, despite the fact that I knew, and she knew that I knew, that it had been her plan which led the consul to open the time tombs and release the thing.
Perhaps you should have been on that pilgrimage, M. Severn, said the CEO.
In a way, I said, I am. Gladstone gestured, and a door to her private quarters opened.
Yes, in a way you are, she said. But if the woman who carries your counterpart is crucified on the shrike's legendary tree of thorns, will you suffer for all eternity in your dreams?
I had no answer, so I stood there and said nothing.
We will talk in the morning after the conference, said Mena Gladstone. Good night, M. Severn.
Have pleasant dreams.